Welcome to the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. I'm your host, David Yosefon, Associate Professor of Law here at Santa Clara University School of Law in sunny Santa Clara, California. This is the fourth episode of our podcast series. The first three involved conversations with scholars, and this episode gives us our first occasion to have a conversation with an activist. I hope some of the activists out there have enjoyed hearing from the scholars. I hope the scholars enjoy hearing from the activists. I hope the liberals out there have enjoyed hearing some of the conservative ideas on this podcast. I hope the conservatives out there have enjoyed hearing some of the liberal ideas that we've been through. My point is not for us all to get along, but rather to put all of our views together, allow them to generate some heat, which might generate some light, and illuminate our way forward. Subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at David Yosefon. That's David Yosefon. I'll tweet it whenever we post a new episode. This episode is sponsored by the Markkula Center for Applied Ethics at Santa Clara University. My guest on the podcast today is Michelle Simon, president of Eat Drink Politics, and the author of an influential book, Appetite for Profit, How the Food Industry Undermines Our Health and How to Fight Back. That book was published in 2006, but Michelle continues to produce voluminous writing on this subject on her blog, Eat Drink Politics, and in numerous reports that her organization authors. Michelle Simon, thanks for being a part of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So your organization has just put out a new report called Clowning Around with Charity, How McDonald's Exploits Philanthropy and Targets Children. And I wanted to talk with you specifically about your findings in this report. But I was hoping initially you might start us off by just telling us about your organization, Eat Drink Politics. What is it and what does it do?
Sure. Well, it's a consulting business on the politics of food and alcohol. And, you know, it's sort of an unusual model. I'm not a NGO or typical kind of advocacy group. Instead, I'm a public health lawyer that consults with other nonprofits and law firms who are in some way or another taking on the food and alcohol industries and trying to protect public health. And so my work focuses on research and writing, really trying to shine a light on industry practices that undermine public policy and make recommendations for improving the environment that we live in so that people can make healthier choices.
That's very interesting. So you're not organized as a nonprofit per se, but you consider yourself an advocacy outfit. Mm-hmm. And you're a private business that is engaged in this kind of reformative work. Is that right?
Yeah, I think that's a great way of putting it. And yeah, it is an unusual business model. But, you know, I have been down the nonprofit road and I decided that wasn't right for me again. And I thought, well, let me try it this way. You know, there are a lot of good groups out there that I'm connected to that I want to help. And it makes sense, you know, to have someone who has my kind of skill set and expertise and can kind of support the groups that are doing this kind of work that maybe don't have someone full-time on staff.
So I'm wondering how this kind of an organization can serve as a model for advocacy work. It is kind of an innovative approach. Do you see other kinds of organizations like this on the horizon or out there in the landscape presently?
Well, I don't know, because then they would be competing with me.
But, right. So you try to ignore them.
I do think. But no, I'm fine. I mean, with bringing, we certainly need more people. I can't handle all of the, you know, nonsense that there is to respond to when it comes to industry practices. So, yeah, I guess what I like to think is a benefit is it's a way of kind of professionalizing this work. In other words, you know, it's not just scrappy activists and you know, NGOs that are constantly trying to get the next grant and worrying about, you know, fundraising. You know, I'm trying to kind of just focus on the work and also bring it to a level of consulting. In other words, that it's, I don't like the word activist. I mean, I'm an advocate, that's fine, but I guess my point is I want to elevate this work to a certain kind of expertise. In other words, it's a specialty that deserves, this kind of professional category to be thinking about and analyzing corporate practices. And I don't think that's something that, except in the realm of politics, right? I mean, certainly there are political consultants that understand the importance of opposition research and your opponent and all of that. But there's no one else really in the public health realm that is focused on corporate practices in the way that I am. And I think, it's an important void that I fill, and we certainly need other groups to be looking at it in that way. And it doesn't have to be, in a private business model the way I have it, but mostly I just want anyone, whatever form it takes, whether it's, NGOs, law firms, or private businesses, to be focused more on corporate practices and how that is undermining public policy and public health.
Well, I think you're a pioneer in this area, so I'm curious about your model, and we here at the podcast will be keeping our eye on it. So you, through your organization, Eat Drink Politics, you produced this report, Clowning Around with Charity, How McDonald's Exploits Philanthropy and Targets Children. So I know this has been a longstanding research project of yours and research area of interest of yours. Was this produced for a particular client with a particular charge?
Well, there was actually two other groups involved that funded me to write this report. One is Corporate Accountability International, and they're a nonprofit that has had a campaign focused around McDonald's now for several years, and that I have worked with as a consultant on that campaign. And then the other partner is the Small Planet Fund, and specifically the author Anna LaPay, who has been also working with Corporate Accountability in partnership. And so the three of us really kind of came together over this idea to shine a light on McDonald's charitable activities, and decided that we made a good team, put our heads together, and figured out how to do it.
Before we get into the findings of the report itself, which is extremely interesting, can you give us a general update on where we stand in terms of public policy responses or legal responses or public health responses to the obesity epidemic, which I think has been on the radar explicitly or with some salience now for a number of years? Has progress been made? Are there important regulatory changes? What's your perspective on the current state of affairs in this area generally?
Well, without being too dire and depressing about it, I would say that we are, the good news is that there has been plenty of media coverage and attention focused on what I think of really as the diet-related public health disaster that our nation is in. I'm not really so much concerned about how much people weigh as much as what their health outcomes are. So, it's really more... awareness is the right word, and certainly around food systems and local food. And, there's no question we've had an explosion since I've been working on these issues in just attention being paid to the problem of our broken food system, to our epidemic of diabetes and heart disease and so forth due to poor diet. However, that attention, awareness, and focus has not really translated to very many tangible public policy outcomes. And, we have certainly some improvements for some segments of the population, mainly in terms of, better access to fresh local food. There's a growing food movement, but that's been rather, marginalized and segmented to that part of the population that has access to their local farmers market. And in some areas, there's been certainly improvements in low-income people's access and so forth. But, the other sort of 95% of Americans are still kind of faced with the same challenges we've had for a long time, which is living in a food environment that does not support good health and just simply not having access to the right kinds of foods, and, of course, being bombarded 24/7 with the marketing messages to eat all the wrong kinds of foods. And so we have not had a good public policy response to that overall situation, and there's many reasons for that. Of course, mostly focused around the power of the food industry and politics as usual in Washington, D.C. So I would say we are at still a very kind of early stage of development when it comes to actually fixing this problem that we're in.
Well, you and others have certainly been very critical of the McDonald's Corporation for their role in the obesity epidemic and their role in influencing or stymieing the development of more intense regulation that would be responsive to the problem. This report focuses on McDonald's philanthropic efforts and is highly critical of that. Can you summarize your findings from this report?
Sure. Well, I should say, you know, the reason that we even looked at this was because McDonald's is very good at kind of using charity as a shield for criticism that's leveled against them, particularly around the use of Ronald McDonald as its mascot and targeting children. So we thought it would be a good idea to kind of take a closer look at how McDonald's engages in charitable activities. And, you know, it was pretty eye-opening, I have to say, to realize just how much this company uses charity, particularly the Ronald McDonald House Charities, their namesake, as a public relations and marketing vehicle, relative to how little that corporation gives to charity in general, and in particular to its namesake charity. So specifically, we found at the global level, on average, McDonald's is giving about 20% of the Ronald McDonald House Charities revenue. So in other words, if you look at all of the sources of revenue of this global entity, McDonald's giving is reflecting only 20% of it. If you look at the local level, so like, you know, there's 300 some odd houses all over the globe, it's even less money. So the way it works is that the McDonald's corporate gives money to the global entity, and that's where we found that 20% giving. And then at the local level, where there may be McDonald's franchises forming partnerships and somehow connected to the local house, you know, that level of giving is more like 10%. And the houses themselves, actually, we found this out through their own disclaimers that they have on their websites, where they have to really kind of explain away McDonald's relationship with them by saying, gee, you know what, it may seem like McDonald's is covering us because, after all, we're called the Ronald McDonald House, but in fact, we only get about 10% of our revenue to operate this important service, and it's a very important service that they're providing to let parents stay in a place nearby where their children are getting treatment in a hospital. But, you know, keep in mind, public, that we need your help because McDonald's isn't really giving us much money. So, you know, that was the most eye-opening finding of the report. And then we looked more generally at McDonald's giving. We saw that they were out of step with other corporate giving. They give about a third of what other corporations give in general. And then we also looked at the role of McDonald's in schools. So, and again, using charity as an excuse, McDonald's sends Ronald McDonald into schools to do some fundraising for the local charity, or to engage in these events called McTeachers Nights. So they get teachers to actually, you know, operate the cash registers in a local McDonald's, and the families come, and this is all done under the guise of raising money for the school. But when you do the math, it comes out to about like a dollar per student in some cases. So another great marketing vehicle for McDonald's, but not really significant in the way of charity.
That last example is really staggering. I know if we had a law school McTeacher's night, I don't think I would be there flipping. Maybe if they had some veggie burgers, I might be there to flip a few. But so Ronald McDonald House strikes us as one of the most prominent charities in the United States. They at least have a large presence in the charitable landscape. And they provide the service, as you say. They set up places for parents to be able to stay in near hospitals when their children are in hospitals. But it turns out that when you look into it, McDonald's is only giving 20% of their budget, 20% of the budget of the Ronald McDonald House. So they're getting a lot of bang for their buck, and
right.
misleading not consumers in this area, but really misleading, I guess, the public generally, or misleading consumers who might feel better about patronizing a McDonald's mm-hmm. because they think, you know, maybe the food's bad for me, but given the fact that they contribute, you know, usefully to my community, I feel a little less bad, or I feel a little better about eating at McDonald's. But that consumer, if I'm reading the report correctly, what I'm taking away from the report is that consumer has been misled about what McDonald's is or what McDonald's is doing in very much the same way, or in a way that parallels how they may be misled about the health consequences of eating McDonald's hamburgers from other marketing that the company engages in.
Right. Well, I would say that as far as who's being misled, I mean, everyone is being misled about the role of McDonald's in relation to that charity. I mean, I did some informal polling, and, you know, if you ask even smart people who don't eat at McDonald's, let alone, you know, the average person on the street who just might, pretty much anyone you ask will tell you that they thought McDonald's funds the Ronald McDonald houses.
Sure,
100%.
I mean, I certainly assume that.
It's a natural assumption. It sounds like they would, right? So really, I think it's fair to say that almost everyone, you know, other than those perhaps most closely connected to the charity that are having to spend so much time doing fundraising, thought that McDonald's was funding it 100%. So, you know, what are the consequences of that? Well, you know, as you said, may make some people feel better about eating there who might, or, you know, otherwise have some qualms about it. But more importantly to me is the public policy implication. So like I said earlier, you know, McDonald's is very adept at using this charity as a shield. So when Corporate Accountability International, my partner on this report, several years ago started a campaign called Retire Ronald, which was, you know, to really get underneath this insidiousness of this clown as a marketing vehicle for the company towards children, the most, you know, frequent response we heard in back from McDonald's corporate was, oh, no, no, we couldn't possibly retire our mascot, Ronald, because he's the face of our charity, right? He's doing all this good work in the community regarding this important charity. Well, that's just a brilliant deflection, you know, for any kind of criticism that's leveled against the use of that clown. I mean, as long as, you know, we've got this mascot doing all this good over here, you know, then you can just stop paying attention to all the ways that he's marketing to children over there. So, you know, to me, that's
They might easily deploy yeah. another mascot in association with Ronald McDonald charities, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or the Ronald McDonald
house. Well, sure. I mean, right. But, you know, and it's not like it's an accident, right? I mean, I found, you know, the very origins of the Ronald McDonald House was a marketing vehicle. I mean, I should say the origins of charity work in general before Ronald McDonald House came along in the 70s. It was back in the 50s when McDonald's realized in its very early days that charity was an important marketing vehicle. That was the reason they got into it. And then when the idea of starting a house came along, well, my God, you know, brilliant, attached the Ronald McDonald name to it. It's got children associated with it. And, you know, we've got the whole thing all in one ball, you know, rolled up in one ball. So, yeah.
I want to ask you more about the policy implications or responses to this, but one other anecdote from the report that you've got to tell is about the customer donation boxes.
Right. So, you know, McDonald's makes a very big deal about the fact that they've got these boxes in many of the outlets and at the drive-thru where customers can put their coins in there. And they, you know, they go so far as to say that the donation boxes are the single best vehicle or the single way that we raise the most money for the Ronald McDonald House charities. And, you know, and then you have to stop and think about what that means, which is that this is, you know, spare change that's coming from McDonald's customers, right? In other words, McDonald's is boasting about how much money, and it turns out to be, you know, a significant sum because there are so many damn outlets in the world. I mean, it is true that small donation, I mean, they like to say small donations add up because they're everywhere, right? I mean, when you have 14,000 outlets in this country alone. So, so internationally, the figure is $50 million. And it's just fun to what we do is compare that to, for 2011, the amount that McDonald's gave overall, which is $34 million. So that tells us that McDonald's customers are 1.5 times more generous than McDonald's itself. So it's just amusing to have McDonald's basically boasting about how much money is coming through these donation boxes when that's not money from McDonald's. That's from their customers. And even some of the individual houses that we called to interview recognized this. We wanted to know, well, how much of the donation box money at the local level, for example, stays in the community versus going back to national. It turns out it's okay. It's about 75-25. So in other words, if, you know, the local donation box in St. Louis gives 75% of that money, stays at the local St. Louis house, and then the other 25% goes back to national for administrative purposes, whatever. Okay. But the point is, in the course of doing this type of research and having conversations with the houses, this one director told us, well, remember, that money isn't actually from McDonald's. That money is coming from the community. And it's like, yeah, right. I mean, it's just fascinating to hear that, you know, that she got it. And it was almost like she was annoyed to have McDonald's taking credit for the generosity of the community members.
So when McDonald's expresses in its public statements and in its reports on its website about its community activities, it attributes mm-hmm. money that is passing through the coin donation boxes. It attributes that's money from it claims this is money that McDonald's gave. When money that the customers directly.
Yeah, they say these are from them, but it's like they're basically taking credit for it. I mean, it doesn't. Uh-huh. You know, they are including it in their, reporting. So it's like, okay, well, we've given this, and then there's all this extra money that we raised through our donation boxes. It's like, okay, but what does that have to do with? I mean, they are the vehicle. I mean, there's no question. But yeah, I mean, it does. But it is interesting how much they boast about it, with no hint of irony.
And also just the mathematics of it, as you point out, that there's 1.5 times as much money coming through those coin boxes than through their McDonald's direct.
Right. Than their own $27 billion in revenue. Right. Yeah.
So as I'm reading the report, I'm wondering, I guess I know the answer, but I want to try to make it explicit or hear your take on it, is why do it seems like one of the organizations or outfits that are being exploited here are the charitable houses, are the houses themselves. That bear the name Ronald McDonald House, but is only getting 20% of their budget from the McDonald's Corporation. So why do they tolerate this relationship instead of, requiring that it's sponsored in part by McDonald's or taking the name off it altogether? And I guess a similar question about the schools. Why do the schools tolerate the influence from McDonald's when they're really getting a pretty low dollar amount from them at the end of the day?
Yeah, well, the schools are a harder case to make. I mean, obviously, these days, schools think that they need money from anywhere they can get it, and I'm sure that most schools don't even do the math that we did. You know, they just know, oh, we're getting $1,000. They don't realize, well, if you have 1,000 students, you know, what does that really look like? I mean, so they're just seeing this as a fun, exciting thing. I mean, unfortunately, we really haven't stigmatized yet enough in our society for the average person in a school setting to see that this is a problem. However, interestingly, I did interview somebody in Canada who was like appalled at the whole idea that there was such a thing called McTeacher's Nights, and said she was a teacher in Alberta, and she's like, oh, no, we don't have that at all. I mean, so there may be some cultural differences. Not to say that obviously McDonald's has influence in Canada, but apparently not in the schools in Alberta anyway. But as far as the houses go, I mean, it's a lot more complicated there because, you know, they don't really have a choice. I mean, first of all, there are these licensing agreements with McDonald's. I mean, I suppose the house isn't, you know, bound by them, and if a house wanted to go off on their own, perhaps they could. I mean, most of them are separately incorporated. But, you know, I just think that they're caught up in this is kind of how it's been. This is the attachment we have to this company. You know, it would be complicated to kind of start over. I mean, what's interesting, though, is I did see in one or two instances that McDonald's sort of took over an entity that previously was not branded, you know, the Ronald McDonald House. So I think there was, for example, one location in Southern California that had been like, you know, the Children's Cancer Society or something mm-hmm. like that. And then they got kind of bought out. It's funny because there was a quote from a CEO, former CEO of McDonald's, who said, he was explaining the whole structure of the charities, and he said, we've sort of franchised the charity business. And so in this case in Southern Cal, they basically bought out, you know, paid off enough money, I guess, to get the naming rights, and then forevermore that, you know, Children's Cancer Center was the Ronald McDonald House. So, you know, I just think that that's the way it's set up. Most of them probably don't question it. They may not, I mean, while they do seem to acknowledge some liability, at least in confusing people to think that McDonald's covers it, you know, I think some of them do also see some positive aspects of having the name. There's certainly some sorts of, you know, forms of support they get from the mothership. But, you know, I would love to do a survey to find out, you know, which ones might think that they have more to gain by detaching themselves from the McDonald's name, both for being able to get perhaps more donations, and also because increasingly this company's name is a liability.
But they're trying, as you point out, they're trying to make it less of a liability by associating it with this kind of charitable activity. I want to try to dig into some of the policy issues, both from a very broad analytic level and I guess a detailed level as well. So if you often hear it said by proponents of corporate social responsibility or a version of corporate social responsibility that corporations should be encouraged to act in a socially responsible manner, and they should recognize that it's good business to do so, because consumers respond well to it, communities respond well to it, even workers do. And so this version of corporate social responsibility would argue that McDonald's should and would be eager to get involved in charitable activity in order to reap those benefits, which will not be profit sacrificing for its shareholders, but will ultimately be profitable for its shareholders. But I think this report tells an aspect of that story that is, if you will, under-theorized or underappreciated, which is that there is that what's valuable is the perception of socially responsible activity, and that is manipulable in the same way that consumer risk perceptions are manipulable. And if you're a firm that's particularly good at it, then you can get that greenwash, if you want to call it, or that corporate responsibility association more cheaply than firms that are not good at it. So you say that McDonald's actually gives, 0.32% of its pre-tax profits, whereas most leading corporations give about 1% of its pre-tax profits. But public perception very well may be that McDonald's is a leading corporate donor. So what might we do to better render our own consumers, the public's perceptions accurate about the kinds, about the extent to which firms like this are really engaged in charitable activity? I mean, obviously, producing reports like this is one step. Do you think of what might be done in terms of the regulation of charitable activity or FTC regulation, false advertising regulation, deceptive advertising regulation to confront this problem?
Yeah, well, you're asking a pretty big picture question there. And I mean, it is true that you're right that the more sophisticated companies like McDonald's are getting, you know, way more PR bang than the buck that they're contributing, and it is fascinating to really unpack that. I mean, what we can do about it, it's interesting because I have a friend who works in one of the attorney general offices, and, you know, she asked me what would I want to say to state AGs, and I thought about it, and I thought about, you know, are there legal implications here? I mean, there may or may not be. I don't really think anything, I mean, other than I haven't looked closely enough at the finances to be able to say. But in terms of what they're doing PR-wise, I mean, look, I don't think there's anything actionable here. I mean, they are engaging in PR. That's what companies do. I don't think it rises to the level of deceptive advertising exactly. It's just that, you know, it makes sense, and most people would assume if the charity is called Ronald McDonald House that they would be funding it 100%. It just happens to not be so. I mean, and everything I found was, you know, from publicly available information. So it's not like they're even hiding it. It's just that most people, like I said, don't go to the lengths that I do to try and really bring out the information. So, you know, I guess I always try to say people need to be skeptical, right? I mean, anytime you hear a corporation say anything, you should assume that it's there's something else behind it, there's a context for it. You know, that's mostly what my work is about, is trying to get people to listen to everything a corporation says with a skeptical ear, right? And to look behind it, to always look for the detail. What does this mean? Why is this company saying this in this moment? The context, what are they trying to hide? You know, what could be said instead of?
The nature of the problem is that we believe it is meaning, in a meaningful sense, if not in a strictly legal sense, it is deceptive. It is misleading in a way that we want to call important. And yet, we might not want to say, well, they should be liable to a lawsuit based on these kinds of statements. And so, you know, the question is, how can we solve that problem of deception? And you know, it's predictable. I think you point out, you know, why should we be skeptical of corporate statements of this sort? Because it's predictable that they're going to make these statements when you look at the structure and motivations behind corporate decision making.
Yeah, I mean, I think the solutions lie, David, not really in, you know, sort of better regulations by the FTC, but in social stigmatization. Uh-huh. So, like, you know, we had a couple of great quotes from a doctor named Yoni Friedhoff, who happens to be based in Canada, but, you know, he made the point that we would never, ever accept a charity attached to the hospital called, you know, the Philip Morris Children's Wing, right? And we wouldn't have a couple other great examples like that. Like, you know, we wouldn't have the Budweiser burn unit of the hospital. So why do we accept, you know, the Ronald McDonald wing like there is in one hospital? So it's really about stigmatizing this particular company and industry in a way that we have with other industries. So, you know, I think once we get to that, you know, phase of our societal development, that's when, you know, people will go, what the hell are we thinking? You know, we will look back at this time, hopefully someday, just like we do now, look at, like, you know, the crazy stuff we accepted at one time regarding smoking in this country. You know, we will look back on how did we ever accept Ronald McDonald, this mascot that's promoting unhealthy food to toddlers, as, you know, the name of a charity for children.
Okay, so let me ask you this abstract policy perspective on this question. Some scholars, Milton Friedman comes to mind, and also contemporary scholars, are of the view that corporations should not be involved in charitable activity at all. Friedman's view was that business of corporations should be to make profits for its shareholders. He wasn't against charity, far from it. He always was looking for ways to expand non-governmental kind of charitable or social or community activity. And his view was that McDonald's should, he didn't speak about McDonald's in particular, but in this context, McDonald's should pay greater dividends to its shareholders, and the shareholders should give to charities if that's what they want to do with that money. Or, you know, another perspective that you might see it even from the consumer perspective, which is that whatever money McDonald's is giving to charities is in some sense impounded into the cost of the cheeseburger, right? And if McDonald's didn't give any charitable giving at all, then at least theoretically they could reduce the cost of the hamburger by some margin and still have the same amount of profits for its shareholders, and then consumers would have another couple pennies in their pocket. And if the consumers wanted to give to charities,
the donation box.
Yeah, they could put it in the donation box. So in a sense, corporate charitable giving is really taking money from shareholders, more obviously, less obviously from workers and from consumers mm-hmm. and giving the money to charity. Why should corporations be doing this at all rather than leaving it to their, reducing prices to their other stakeholders who could then do it themselves? Do you have a perspective mm-hmm. on that?
Yeah, I do. And, you know, it's something that we thought about in terms of the recommendations we want to make, you know, and my partners and I came together and said, well, are we saying if McDonald's isn't giving enough, quote unquote, based on, you know, the PR return that they're getting, does that mean we think they should give more? And we came to the conclusion that no, that was not one of our recommendations, that McDonald's should give more. Rather, McDonald's should instead, you know, stop using this charity as a PR vehicle. And while we didn't make this explicit in one of our recommendations, but we did address it, you know, you raised the labor issue, which I think is extremely relevant, given that McDonald's has come under fire increasingly in recent months for not paying its workers a living wage, so much that we're seeing outright strikes and, you know, much more better organized protests because of workers who are just fed up with living on slave wages. So we have a great quote from Joanne Lowe, the head of the Food Chain Workers Alliance, at the end of the report that says, the best thing McDonald's could do for charity, for giving back to the community, is to pay its workers a living wage. And, you know, the way I put it was, if McDonald's claims to care about children, why doesn't it care about all its workers who happen to be parents and, you know, have children on SNAP, right? I mean, we just had this crazy thing go viral where a phone conversation, you know, a helpline that McDonald's set up for its workers who are struggling to make ends meet. And the response of this person who was saying, yeah, I can't pay my own food bills was, oh, well, here's how to sign up for food stamps. You know, I mean, if you saw, there was this fantastic report that came out a couple of weeks ago showing how much the fast food industry is relying on taxpayer dollars in the form of various federal public assistance programs because its workers are struggling so much that they have to sign up for food stamps and Medicaid and the rest to the tune of $7 billion a year. And, of course, McDonald's is at the top of that food chain at over $1 billion a year. In other words, the taxpayer is subsidizing the slave wages that McDonald's and other fast food companies are paying to their workers. So, you know, it's exactly what you said. They're shifting money away from the people who really need it in their operation, namely the workers at the lowest rungs, and then, you know, putting a little bit of money into charity and making a big deal about it, all the while the taxpayer is picking up the rest of the tab.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting perspective. So you might expect a progressive or liberal or critical type organization to be sort of hammering McDonald's to give more in charitable activity. But I think that your report and your perspective suggests that that would only be inviting more extensive use of what you're interpreting as a device of insulating McDonald's from scrutiny and misleading consumers and regulators generally.
I don't want the conclusion from what I'm saying to be that corporations should engage in charity at all. So, I'm saying charity begins at home. Right? I mean, that's really what I wanted to have as one of my kind of subheads, but it didn't make it into the final cut. So, you know, I feel like, look, McDonald's is $27 billion company. It's paying its CEO, you know, an obscene amount of salary, and yet its workers are suffering. So let's, you know, do some internal distribution of the profits and pay its workers, you know, better wages. And then if there's some extra money left over after that, sure, if it wants to throw some towards charity, preferably in a way that doesn't, you know, promote its junk food brand, maybe write a kind of anonymous check here and there. You know what I mean? Like, I don't mind corporations engaging in charity, but it should not be a substitute for paying its workers properly. It should not be mainly a PR vehicle. And, you know, it shouldn't be done in the way that this company is doing it.
From your perspective on corporate social responsibility generally, and I know you're involved in, you're in the trenches, and you see the legislative sausage being made, and you see what kinds of advocacy from both sides or all sides go into that process. And so I guess what I want to ask you is, do you think it's plausible, and I know you're a lawyer as well, so is it plausible to expect that McDonald's might reform its own internal governance to give greater attention to increasing workers' wages, increasing the healthfulness of its product for its consumers. Is there a way that McDonald's can be made internally to have a governance dynamic that orients it in that socially responsible direction? Or is that kind of impulse going to have to come from outside of the corporation through regulations imposed from government as such?
Yeah. Well, I don't see how it can come internally as long as, you know, as you know, corporations are part of a political, economic, and social construct that they didn't create. So, you know, I always like to say, look, it's not any one corporation's fault that they have to compete in this environment. And that's really what drives down wages, what keeps the food cheap, what, you know, forces these companies into engaging in very, you know, exploitive practices. And it's just, it's a system. So I don't see why McDonald's on its own. I mean, they are an industry leader, yes, and they can make some changes here and there, and they have. And that's great to the extent that they have any positive impact. You know, I'm all for that. I'm all, certainly all for pushing corporations to engage in better practices, whether it has to do with their, you know, sourcing from less, you know, harmful factory farms, or hopefully treating workers a little bit better, et cetera. But I think to make more significant impacts, there has to be, you know, government regulations that even the playing field, right? I mean, the same companies who complain about government regulation and then they say, well, we're not going to be the ones to do it ourselves. Well, then why don't you lobby for, you know, an industry-wide increase in minimum wage? Wouldn't that be, you know, the solution to that problem? So, you know, I just think there's so much hypocrisy going on with these companies wanting to have it both ways. And, you know, but I'd also be interested in, you know, more about this than me, but, you know, how can we change some of the rules of the game so that corporations don't feel so obligated to only worry about the bottom line? Are there ways to require them even to care more about societal impacts of their business practices so that we're not, you know, forced with such a narrow range of tools in the toolbox to get companies to behave more responsibly?
Right. I think that social construct, that social and legal construct, I like the way you put that, they're operating within a construct that they did not create. It's a set of rules and expectations at the level of the board of directors that charges directors to manage the firm in the interest of shareholders. And they're going to look for, they're going to, you know, acting in furtherance of those fiduciary obligations, they're going to pursue those profits wherever they can be had, knowing that if they don't do it, other firms that are similarly charged will pursue it. The problem,
yeah, not to mention they could even get sued for not doing it.
Yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. And yet, so given that construct, if you say, well, then we're going to have to look outside of the corporation, we're going to have to look at government to impose a regulatory structure to curb the appetite, to use your phrase, to curb that appetite for profit. Unfortunately, what we then find is that corporations are also active in that political arena, which your newsletter and your organization has tracked, you know, with truly saddening detail, you know, that it's not as if that government apparatus or regulatory apparatus is operating in a vacuum. You also have McDonald's and other corporations actively pursuing profit in the regulatory arena, in the legislative arena, by trying to stymie the development of the very kind of external restraints that might be imposed on them.
Right. Well, you were asking specifically how to change kind of the rules of the game, and I was saying, well, you're not going to, McDonald's isn't going to be able to change the rules of the game. Perhaps if, you know, we found a way to change the rules for how corporations operate or whatever in some other mechanism. But if you're asking me specifically about, say, you know, getting McDonald's to stop marketing to children, I would say, well, yeah, we're not going to get the federal government to help us in that regard. And so what that means is building a political movement to put, you know, outside pressure on McDonald's and other companies to do the right thing. So, you know, I guess I think the change kind of comes from outside, in the sense that, you know, building the movement of people to force corporations to do the right thing. And, you know, that's what we're seeing, is some of that happening. It's just not quite as strong as it should be yet.
Yeah. So I've heard you say that now a few times, and I think now I take that to be your answer, that or at least an answer, which is that you're not in this, certainly in this report, or you're not looking for a reform internally from corporate governance, or perhaps that seems beyond reach at this time. You're not looking necessarily even for a governmental or legislative response, because that seems implausible given the presence of corporations in that arena. And so your appeal really appears to be to consciousness raising and the public at large to be aware of this dynamic and to be sensitized to it.
Right. I mean, that's certainly an important step to change, right, to get people to understand what's really going on. And then, you know, that dose of skepticism then, you know, sort of infiltrates their behavior and talking to other people, and it changes the whole sort of social norms that we live under as more people, you know, get to understand that, gee, McDonald's doesn't actually fund Von McDonald House as much as we thought, then maybe we won't, you know, be so generous, and when we see the next news story about the local house, maybe we'll have some more skepticism about the role of that company and that charity. And then that, you know, it's a social norming change that I think has to happen as laying the groundwork towards then putting that, turning that social pressure towards the company to change its ways.
So how has the reaction been to this report? Generally, has McDonald's responded to it? Have you gotten interest in it more generally? Are you satisfied with it? I mean, you obviously put a lot of work into something like this. I know, you know, sometimes I write a law review article and finally it gets published and I don't get much response. And then I thought, oh, it'll be 2-3 generations down the road before it's really understood and appreciated. But something like this, you're looking for a more, I would think, at least from an authorial perspective, it would be nice to see reaction. What kind of reaction have you had?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, you need a big press team behind you, David, to get out your work more broadly. So, you know, we did a big press push, and I'm happy to say that we got some good coverage, first off from USA Today. And, of course, that helps the whole story go national. And then we've had quite a bit of follow-up, too, from other outlets. So, you know, I'm just happy to say that the press has picked up on it. And so McDonald's was forced to respond, because when USA Today calls, they really have no choice. So they put out this, you know, pretty silly statement that other outlets picked up on, claiming that the report was biased and misleading, with, of course, no specifics to point to on either of those counts. And then, you know, a more general statement you would expect, like, oh, this is an insult to the hardworking, you know, volunteers for our charity and all this kind of stuff. You know, again, just spinning it as it's all about the good work that they're doing. And that was, you know, to be expected. So that's McDonald's response. And as far as, you know, other responses, I think people are surprised. I mean, there was a fun local news story in Philadelphia where the reporter found out that, in fact, there was no money coming from McDonald's corporate to the local Philadelphia house, and that only 10% of the revenue was coming from the local franchises. And so they actually did some interviews of, you know, the man on the street to say, wow, what do you think about that? And of course, people were surprised to find out. So that was fun to see that kind of very localized response and reaction and coverage. And then, you know, and I will say we've gotten also, like on my blog, you can see some comments that I was bracing myself for, from people who have had a positive experience with one of the local houses, where, you know, they think that I'm criticizing the charity, which I'm not, you know. And, you know, I, like I said, I expected it was still disappointing to see people say, oh, why are you criticizing this charity? It's so important, you know, and my child was in the hospital. And I said, you know, we were so clear that the charity is important, all the more reason we should be scrutinizing it. You know, I'm interested in actually helping the charities raise money by exposing the fact that they need the money, because McDonald's doesn't give much to it. So, you know, in that sense, there was some mixed response. But overall, you know, the media certainly covered it well to make that point clear. And, you know, I think we're just raising the consciousness. And in that sense, I'm satisfied with it.
Congratulations on that kind of response, and I'm sure that there's going to be more of it, and I'm sure that you're inspiring others to get involved in this kind of work. What advice would you offer? Just we're wrapping up here. And by the way, the blog that Michelle referred to can be found on her website, which is Eat Drink Politics, all one word, eatdrinkpolitics.com. And you can link to the blog on there and all of her reports. It's a fantastic resource. But Michelle, I was going to say young people, but also old people and people in between who are looking to get into this kind of work, this kind of advocacy or professional work generally that is oriented towards corporate social responsibility. My students are lawyers, maybe a lot of law students or lawyers may be listening to this podcast, but also people in other fields. What advice for somebody who's been in the game for a long time as you have, what advice would you give to somebody who's looking to make their mark in this area?
Mm-hmm. To a law student or in general?
Well, maybe to law students in particular.
Yeah. I would say, in either case, you know, I guess my big rallying cry is to whatever issue you're engaged with, assuming that it has some kind of political orientation to it, which most do, and particularly food issues certainly do, I just always like to emphasize to not be thinking about the political implications and the corporate influence of whatever it is, you know, whatever social ill that you're trying to fix, because odds are there's some economic corporate interest behind it, and then it's not enough to just be, you know, trying to fix problems by getting a better regulation or, you know, getting healthier food into your neighborhood or whatever kind of the more safe, I guess, happy approach is to fixing problems, that we have to absolutely address the underlying cause, which I could say in most cases has some corporation or industry behind it. And that, you know, whether even if you think you're just focused on the law, odds are there's a political angle to it, and that it's so important to be looking at these issues in that broader context and to looking for how to engage with people in other areas of specialty. You know, like I've learned a ton about economics. I never studied economics, but I have to learn about it. If I want to, you know, understand industry practices, I damn well have to understand how economics works in that context. So, you know, just really thinking more broadly about how these various specialties intersect, and that to really have a broader awareness and approach that focuses on the politics of these issues.
Michelle Simon, thank you so much for being a part of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. We'll continue following the work of Eat Drink Politics and hope to have you as a guest again in the future.
That sounds great, David. Thanks so much for having me. I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Okay, that's it. That's our interview with Michelle Simon of Eat Drink Politics. I hope that you enjoyed that conversation. Maybe it deepened some of your own commitments. Maybe it changed some of your own commitments, changed some of your thinking, deepened some of your thinking. Maybe it had some impact on you that I can't imagine. Maybe it had some impact on you that's none of my business. Maybe you don't quite know what to make of Michelle Simon's reflections until you hear the next episode of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast. So subscribe to us on iTunes. Follow us on Twitter at David Yosifon. That's David YOSIFON. And we'll have another episode up for you in about a week's time. Until then, I'm going to ask you to cue up your outgoing music, your own private personal outgoing music in your mind. Can't charge you for that. No royalties between the ears. At least not yet. It's not that I object to paying royalties. Anybody out there wants to hear some specific kind of outgoing music and wants to sponsor the outgoing music portion of the Corporate Social Responsibility Podcast, get in touch with us on Twitter. See what we can't make happen. Until then, select your own Bob Dylan, your own Beethoven, your own Johnny Cash, whatever you've got. Cue it up. Let it roll. I'll talk to you next time.